Good evening, and thank you very much for coming to Haggadah Night by the Yeshiva University Torah Mitzion Beit Midrash Zichron Dov. This is our second of two for the season. Our first one was at the Bayit last Tuesday evening, and here at Shai Shemayim. I think this is our fourth or fifth year of doing it, and I'd like to thank Jason and Raquel Goldberg for dedicating it in memory of their daughter Tamima. I also want to thank Rabbi Strauchler for once again giving us the opportunity to present the program here. I also want to make a couple of technical announcements. First of all, the source sheets are over there by the hot water. They're all in one packet, a new step towards convenience. We have an email list for the Haggadah Night programs, and I intend to send out the link for the recording from tonight, as well as the Bayit recording to that email list. So if you didn't sign in yet, please make sure that you sign in. The sign-in sheets are also by the hot water, and then you'll receive the recording from tonight, as well as the recording from the program at the Bayit. Also, our Seder Companion is currently being printed, or I'm hoping it's being printed. We sent it to press on Thursday. But it should be out in shuls all around Toronto this coming Shabbat. It has 19 Divrei Torah from members of the Beit Midrash, past and present, as well as university students who learn with us, and on all different parts of the Seder. So please make sure to catch that as well in a shul around Toronto. In the event that you're not sure whether your shul carries it, email me, and I can direct you to where you can download it as well. In the event that for some reason you have a cell phone and you could please silence it, that would be extremely helpful. And with that in mind, we're going to get started. The format for this evening is the same as the format every year, which is to say, four thoughts. Each one is supposed to be 10 minutes or less. The idea being to provide something that people can actually use at their Seder, where if you run on for more than 10 minutes presenting a thought, you are done. So even 10 minutes I know is a stretch. But nonetheless, that's the idea. But all the things I've said until now do not count towards my 10 minutes. So we're going in the order in which the thoughts that we're presenting tonight appear in the Seder. So in other words, mine is towards the beginning of the Seder, and then the next, and the next, and the next. And if I had a packet up here, I would be able to tell you what the next and the next are. But you have the packets, so you can see for yourselves. But the four thoughts will each be presented by different members of our Beit Midrash. So my topic is, as you see on your sheets, creative karpas. Tell me, what do you use for karpas? Potato, celery, parsley,
asparagus.
Okay, now we're getting exotic. Asparagus. Someone's going to say arugula. No one's going to say arugula. All different nice ideas for karpas. I'm going to advocate something entirely different, which we began to use at my family's Seder, about 15, 20 years ago. And it certainly fits halachically, and I think it's a beautiful thing to do at your Seder. And I have to preface, though, by saying I'm not advocating for people to change their minhagim, to change their family practices. As a general rule, I'm a big believer in the power of minhag, the importance of minhag. The first three sources that I brought on the sheets, and because I have less than 10 minutes, I'm not reading out all the sources, but you have them there for yourselves to see. Stress the importance of minhag, the importance of custom. The first source, going back to Rav Shvira Gaon, as I wrote there, 10th century Babylon, speaks about the power of communal practice such that it will overpower the standards that are set up in commercial halacha, in commercial law, meaning communal practices can actually be governed based on communal custom when you're dealing with financial matters, as opposed to the what should have been the default halacha, the default law. Stronger than that, Rav Hai Gaon, writing in the same era, roughly, in source number 2, talks about the practices that we have in blowing shofar. And Rav Hai Gaon said, in the context of discussing what the sound of a trua is supposed to be, he says the only way we know anything at all in Judaism about what we do and how to do things is minhag, is the way Jews do things. How does a tkiah sound? How does a trua sound? How does a shvarim sound? Go back to how your ancestors did it. Minhag, custom, is the backbone of Judaism. It's what tells us how to do what we do on so many different levels. And then finally, minhag is what personalizes Judaism. The Chasam Sofer, Rabbi Moshe Sofer, has a reputation for being against innovation. Well, take a look at what he said in source number 3, and I'll just read you my translation aloud. He says, all of the halacha contained in the Shulchan Aruch, all the law in the code of Jewish law, is that which was given equally to all Israel, with no one excluded, yet he who possesses only Torah does not really even possess Torah. For then his performance becomes merely habit and custom passed on from generation to generation. He wants you to personalize, to develop customs, to develop practices that you carry in your family that make Judaism yours, that resonate with you personally. And therefore, I don't want to tell people, get rid of your customs, you know, do something entirely new. What I'd like people to think of, though, is either if you're in a position where classically you had your Seder with others and you never really developed your own practice and now you're having your own Seder, or if there's room to add something, add another option for Karpas, I think the following is worth considering. Why do we wash before Karpas at the Seder? Why do we wash? Tumah, impurity, dipping. So the Talmud tells us, it's in source number 4, that anything that is dipped in liquid, when produce is dipped in liquid, you're supposed to wash before you eat it. However, that's a year-round rule. That's not a Passover Seder rule. That speaks to the time of the temple when people are being careful about purity and impurity, and maybe today some people are careful year-round. That doesn't speak to why we would actually wash at the Seder. But that, if you look in your Haggadah, it says you're supposed to wash your hands before the Karpas. So a few different answers are offered. One answer that's offered is because you're commemorating what was done in the temple tonight, and therefore you wash the way they would wash in the temple, and that's a fine answer. Another answer is because we're dipping for a mitzvah and therefore it's special. But take a look at source number 5. Rabbi Yechiel Michal Epstein in his Aruch HaShulchan says, you know why you dip? Why you wash, excuse me? He says, you know why you wash? Because we do many things differently on this night. Because we're trying to do things differently. And why are we doing it differently? In order to interest our children. To get the children to ask questions. That is why we wash, in order to get the kids to ask, why are you washing? Now, if the kid asks, why are you washing, and you say, good question, let's go on, you haven't really gone anywhere. In other words, you have to then, you know, use that. Now they're engaged. Get them into a conversation about the things that are going on at night. But that's number one. Number two, the very fact that we dip the karpas at all, source number 6, a passage out of the Talmud, as for your question about why we dip twice, it is in order to generate a reminder for children, so that children, once again, see that things are different. We want the children to ask questions. We want the kids to be interested. Now, in the event, I'm imagining myself, you know, when I was, you know, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, or frankly, 40 years old, someone passes around, let's say, parsley with a little bowl of salt water, and they expect me to ask questions. You know what question they're going to get from me, right? Do I have to eat that, right? That's going to be the question. Maybe potatoes are a little different. Potatoes is sort of like French fries. So then I'll be a little more engaged and a little more excited. But honestly, if you want your children to look at this and ask questions, give them something more engaging than a celery stick. What are the requirements for Karpas? What does Karpas have to be at all? What are the rules for Karpas? Borei pri ha'adama, exactly. The only requirement for Karpas is that the blessing should be the blessing of borei pri ha'adama, the one that's usually made on what we call vegetables, but really what it means is not vegetables, but annuals.
Doesn't the Rambam specify it has to be
yerakot? Close. He does say yerakot, but that the word yerakot does not mean something that is green. It's very interesting. Once you get to later commentators, they talk about using something green, and they talk about all sorts of symbolism in the word karpas. If you scramble the letters, you get samach perech, a reference to 600,000 Jews doing backbreaking labor, and those are all nice ideas. However, the word karpas doesn't appear in the Talmud regarding what you're eating at the Seder. The Talmud doesn't actually say karpas. The word karpas itself is some kind of a wild green that used to grow next to rivers. I gave you reference in source number 7, the Mishnah in Shvi'i. It talks about river karpas. That is certainly true. You have karpas, of course, in the Megillah as well. There's a Dvar Torah in the Seder Companion about that. Look at it. I think Jacob Poslin said his Dvar Torah about that. However, the Talmud doesn't use the word karpas at all. It in fact says what you see in source number 8, which is, they bring before him and he dips, even with chazeret. Chazeret being something that would qualify for maror. And it says you can use that for karpas as well. And then the Gemara tells you, commenting on this, in source number 9, Hecha de'ika sha'ar yirakos. We have other vegetables, so don't use a maror eligible vegetable. Use some other vegetable. But again, the word vegetable does not mean, right? I'm flashbacks to like second grade when the teacher told us that tomatoes actually are fruit, which they are. Vegetable is not a botanical term. What it means here is that which grows on a plant that has to be replanted the next year or that dies back over the course of the winter such that the blessing on it is borei pri ha'adama. Incidentally, why do we want it to be that blessing of borei pri ha'adama? Why? So that it'll count for maror also. That way, you have it in mind, right? It's going to count as well as the blessing for when you have maror later on. But the only rule is that it should be something that gets a borei pri ha'adama. And on that basis, you have more options than just parsley, potatoes, and celery. For example, you could use pineapple. Pineapple's borei pri ha'adama. Or you could use banana. Banana is borei pri ha'adama. Now that is a lot more interesting. Ah, you say in salt water with a question mark at the end of that sentence? Try pineapple in salt water. It is good. If you know anybody who puts salt on oatmeal, I don't know if you know anybody who does, but people do. It actually, same idea, brings out the sweetness. Salt on melon, see that? Yes, believe it or not, melon can work for this also. The bottom line is, you don't have to be stuck to offering only potato, parsley, and celery. Something different. Not only that, Rav Kook talks about karpas as well on an entirely different plane. Rav Kook talked about the fact that within human actions there are means and there are ends. And he says karpas, dipping karpas into a liquid represents a combination of the means and the ends. He says food has nutrients. That's the end. That's the goal. Liquid, on the other hand, is a means of transporting the nutrients to their final location. So liquid he views as the means. And using both of them at the Seder represents a purification of the means and the ends. There's more to say. It's a very mystical idea that he's referring to. But his point is that when you purify the means and the ends, you can enjoy life. Unlike the slave in Egypt, you can eat with pleasure. Well, once again, potato, parsley, celery, not so much. Pineapple, now you're talking. That's something that can bring more pleasure. Not to mention, sorry?
Does a liquid have to contain salt water?
So there's some discussion. I know there are people who use vinegar. I don't know if that's any better. Sorry? Something sweet. That's a really interesting question. I mean, I would say there is the symbolism that we associate with it. Once again, the Gemara itself, I'm not so sure would care. In other words, I don't think the Gemara is tied to that. But it's an interesting question. At what point does it gain that symbolism? Right, the dipping itself is really... I'm not sure. I'd want to look into that. It's an interesting question whether you could change that as well. But the point that I'm trying... Right, the tears are a layer of symbolism, just like the idea of the 600,000 and the Samach Perach for Karpas. I mean, it's written down in plenty of places, but not in the Talmud, no. It's a later idea. But the idea, I'm not sure about changing the salt water. I think it's an interesting point. Certainly the priority Talmudically is simply the dipping. But the point that I want to make, and with that I'll cede the floor, is that you take these options, keep the potato and the parsley there for the purists. Don't, you know, change things wholesale. I talk about the importance of custom. I think it matters. But offering this additional option can be more pleasant. Offering this additional option highlights the interest of the children because it can get them interested and involved potentially if they like pineapple, if they like banana. Banana can fall apart a little in salt water, be careful. But the other advantage of it is that once they've seen it, your children will never forget that the blessing on pineapple and bananas, borei priha adama. Once they've seen that, it'll stay with them forever. So that's my suggestion, and I now see the floor. Who goes next? To Rabbi Alex Hecht. Thank you very much. Thank you so much. So we're now seated at the table. We've had kiddush. We've had our pineapple and salt water, whatever other vegetable we're using for karpas. And then we make this declaration. We lift up the matzah. We say, halach ma'anya, this is the bread of affliction. And we extend an invitation. Kol dichvin yeseh v'yechol. Anyone who is hungry, come and eat. Kol ditzrich yeseh v'yisach. All who are needy, come and partake of the Karban Pesach. So something, this sounds very nice, but something seems a little off, right? We're extending an invitation now, but what's the problem?
We already started.
We're already even a couple steps into the Seder. And now we're saying, anyone who's hungry, come and eat. Our doors closed, we're nice and warm, and now we're extending an invitation. So that's one. Two, what are we saying? Kol ditzer geisei v'yivsak. Anyone who needs, come and partake of our Karban Pesach with us, our Pesach offering. So in the times where we ate the Pesach offering, there was also a problem. If you look at source 2, the Mishnah says, HaPesach eino nechal ela balayla. These are the following are some rules pertaining to the Karban Pesach. It can only be eaten at night. It can only be eaten until midnight. Veino nechal ela limnuya. And it can only be eaten among those who were already part of the group, who already chipped in, and who that lamb was already designated for. So even if our doors were open, even if we wanted to invite someone, at this point it seems too late. So what exactly are we saying with this declaration? So there are a couple of approaches. One is the approach found in the Haggadah with the commentary of Rabbi Moshe Feinstein, and he explains it in a really very sobering way. He says the fact that we no longer have the opportunity to invite anyone is precisely the problem. And in some ways, we're making a confession of that. We're saying, if you look at Source 3, it says we are presently suffering the deprivation of exile as we did long ago in Egypt. And this is all a reminder that because we're not enjoying the Karban Pesach, because we're still in exile, it must mean that we didn't rectify the sins that caused their exile, the sins of not having proper concern for one another. And therefore, we're making that declaration. But he says, what are we saying in addition? Please, God, understand that this is not the result of evil character. We have indeed learned the lessons of exile. Rather, hashat ha'cha, because we are presently here, part of the effects of exile is we have remained preoccupied with our own plight. And that is a shortcoming. But we're telling Hashem, we're declaring, this isn't meant maliciously, but unfortunately with the effects of exile, this is a reality. But next year, we hope to be in a state, we hope to be redeemed and in a situation that reflects the proper level of concern we should have for one another. So that's approach number one. The second approach is the invitation is to those people who are present at the Seder. Look at source 4. Rashi says that points out that a person needs to be hungry on Erev Pesach. In fact, one is not allowed to eat on Erev Pesach past Mincha time. And in fact, one of the sages of the Talmud, Rava, would drink wine the entire Erev Pesach to whet his appetite. I was just thinking, he's also the sage who says the halacha that we need to become drunk on Purim. But he would make sure that he was hungry. And we would say, all who are hungry, come and eat. We're all starving at the Seder. Come, let's begin. And I think this is also an important point, because sometimes there are people at our table itself who are neglected, who may not feel like guests. So part of this declaration is saying to everyone here, you're a guest, you're welcome. All who are here, come and partake. Another approach is by drawing attention to the matzah itself, we're noting the contrast that the matzah itself represents. On one hand, it's called, saying halach ma'anya, it's the bread of affliction. On the other hand, we eat it because it was the food that we had leaving Egypt. So the Ramban, in his commentary on the Torah, explains this as a contrast, that we're saying that at our meal itself there's this dual symbolism. There's the remembering of our poverty and of our affliction, and our celebration of the redemptive nature of the Exodus from Egypt. And to whomever the invitation is aimed at, the concern for people who are in need, whether they're in need at our own tables or in need outside, is something that's very closely tied to Yom Tov and to Pesach in particular. You look at Source 7, Rabbi Moshe Isserles says that it's become the practice on Seder night that the head of the household leads the Birkat HaMazon. Normally, there may be a preference to give it to a guest, but specifically, on Seder night, we try to have the head of the household bless, because presumably, the head of the household has been involved with Haknasas Orchim, with inviting the people at the Seder, and based on the statement in Mishle, Tov Ayin Hu Yivorach, that someone who has a generous eye should bless. So we point out that the very nature of the meal, and then when we finish the meal, this meal was all about welcoming people and having that positive perspective. And the Rambam says, when he discusses the laws of Yom Tov, that we can't just enjoy Yom Tov for ourselves. Even though we have to have simcha, we have to rejoice, have meat and have wine, this can't come at the expense of neglecting the needs of others. And this itself is very much part of Simchat Yom Tov, of proper observance of Yom Tov. And what this declaration does, whether it's aimed at the people who aren't here, at a sense of regret, it's aimed at the people present, or it's reflecting on our situation, it really teaches us mindfulness. Mindfulness to those whom we may have forgotten, mindfulness towards those at our table, and mindfulness of the transformation that we're celebrating from affliction to freedom. And through this mindfulness, perhaps we can realize what the prophet Yeshaya says, Tzion v'mishpat tepadeh v'shaveha v'tzedakah, that Zion will be redeemed through judgment, and those who return to her through charity, that through this positive eye, this welcoming of guests, this should lead to the final redemption.
Good evening. I already feel like Seder night here, because we're talking about all this food, we're talking about meat, we're talking about pineapple, and we're all sitting here listening to the Haggadah go on and on. So the portion of the Haggadah that I wanted to talk about is one that, as I'm going to explain, is not really there. We get to really the main focus of the Haggadah, of the Maggid stage, as we go through detail by detail a number of verses that are found in Sefer Dvarim, and let's look at source number one on the sheet, which is really the section that I'm referring to. Tse ulmad, go out and learn. Ma bikesh Lavan ha'aramila asot liYaakov avinu. What did Lavan try to do to Yaakov? Sheparo lo gazar ela al hazcharim, because Paro only intended to wipe out the male offspring, the male Jewish offspring of the Jews. On the other hand, Lavan bikesh la'akor et hakol. Lavan intended to wipe out everybody. Men, women, children, you name it. And then we go on Shana Emar and we quote a pasuk, and the pasuk is as we're going to see from Sefer Devarim 26, chapter 26. Aramio Veda Viva Yer Mitzrayma Vayagar Shambim Tema Atva Hisham Lagoga Dola Sumvarav, and we go on and on and on, detail by detail by detail, for what seems like the next hour, going through each of a whole section of verses from that part of Sefer Devarim, until we finally get to Vayotzeinu Hashem Mitzrayim Biyad Chazakah Vizran Etiyav Mora Gadol Uvotov Uvmoftim, the final of these verses that we expound. From there, we go off on a little bit of a tangent, not really a tangent because it's about the Otot and Moftim, to the Makot, and then we sort of move towards the conclusion of Magid. Now, why is it that we go through this Parsha so strictly, and we read out these verses and go through word by word, what does this mean, what does that mean, it was this miracle, that miracle, this terrible thing happened, that terrible thing happened? And the answer is, seemingly, it's a Mishnah. And it talks about how to educate children on Seder night. Ulefi da'ato shel ben aviv melamto. In source number 2, according to the intelligence and the ability of the child, his father or her father teaches him or her all or part of these questions that the Mishnah had earlier talked about, those being the questions of manishtana and similar. Matchil bignut, and the Mishnah tells us, we begin with something negative, we begin with the Jewish people's disgrace, umisayim bishvach, and we conclude with their glory. Right? It's like a Disney movie. You want to get to the good, happily ever after ending. So we start with the bad, we get to the good. V'doresh mi'arami oved avi. And now the Mishnah refers back to what we do in the Haggadah. It says we actually expound from the passage of Arami oved avi, which we read to explain that Lavan was trying to wipe everybody out. Ad shi'igmor kol ha'parsha kula, until we conclude the entire Parsha, the entire section in the Torah. So question to everybody, based on what you've seen, do we do this at our Seders? Okay, well, if we look back at the first source, what pasuk do we read? Arami oved avi. So are we following the Mishnah? Resounding yes. That is true. On the other hand, if you actually look at the verses in their place, in Devarim, you'll notice it's actually, first of all, talking about a totally different setting when someone comes in and talks about it, number one. We're not actually talking about Seder night and telling it over to children, but there are also some details that are missing. So I put in the section in source number 3. Does anybody know what context these verses come? Trivia question? Bikurim, exactly, bringing the first fruits to the temple. And we're told at the beginning of source number 3, in verse 5 in chapter 26 of Devarim, V'anita v'amartel lifnei Hashem Elokecha, you shall recite as follows before God. And then we have this entire section, read, all the way down to the final line, V'ata, and now, Hinei heveti et rishit pri adama, I bring the first fruits of the soil, asher natata li Hashem, which you, Hashem, have given me. V'inachta lifnei Hashem Elokecha, you put down your basket with your first fruits, and that's the end of the story. So we would then expect to be reading from the introduction through the conclusion. Fair. And where do we begin? Right after the introduction. Right where it says we begin to recite this, we say, Arami Oved Avi. But where do we conclude based on the quote in the first line, in the first source, in the Haggadah? What is the final verse that we recite? The verse of Vayotzi'enu. And we were taken out. Hey, one second. Ezer, you missed something here. In source number 3, there's another verse after that before we conclude. What happened to that verse? Where did it go? It doesn't seem to be in the Haggadah. So there are a number of approaches to answer this question. And God willing, you'll see a couple in the Seder Companions when they come out. I wanted to present one of the particular approaches in a little bit more detail, although we don't have that much more time here, and that is through another point that's found in that same Mishnah that we read. If you look in source number 4, the Gemara on that Mishnah, the Talmud itself, asks, when we say that you should open with disgrace and end with glory, how exactly do you do that? So the Talmud there brings a machloket, a disagreement between Rav and Shmuel. Rav says one of the ways that we can do this is to talk about our real way back history. If you go really far back in Jewish history, before even going down to Egypt, there's something really bad about the Jews, a secret. We started out as idol worshippers. That's really disgraceful, and that's the way we're going to start our storytelling at the Seder. Shmuel says, no, it's bad enough that we were slaves in Egypt. We weren't doing that great then. That's going to cover our sort of bad news of the day, our disgrace. And the question can be asked, and Rav David Zvi Hoffman asks this question, and he says, pardon me, but I can think of a much easier, better way to open with disgrace and conclude with glory. All of these verses that the Mishnah specifically instructs us to read do exactly that. They talk about us going down to Egypt and being bullied by Lavan, and then how we get out of it. Did the Gemara miss the Mishnah? Why is it that we need an alternative way to talk about our disgrace? One way is enough. And Rabbi Hoffman answers that it all revolves around that final verse. It used to be that we could take care of our obligation to begin with disgrace and end with glory simply by reading this paragraph that we have in source number 3. But you know what? That last verse, Vayivienu el hamakom hazeh, and he brought us to this place, Vayiten lanu et haaretz hazot, and he gave us this land, Eretz zavat chalav udvash, a land flowing with milk and honey, is no longer true. That's true when someone's bringing their first fruits. It was true a long time ago when we were living in the land of Israel and we could bring our Korban Pesach and we were having our Seders like that. But Rav Hoffman says it's not true. And once the Gemara sees that this has changed from the time of the Mishnah, the classic Matchil Bignut Umsayim B'Shevach, the original beginning with disgrace and ending with glory, is no longer valid. The glory part has fallen off. And therefore, we need a new way to begin with disgrace and end with glory. And how is that? Rav and Shmuel both provide their alternatives for us living in Galut. May we speedily have the opportunity to see the time where our Haggadahs are restored to their original form and we no longer need alternate disgrace and alternate glory, and we can conclude with the glory of Vayivienu el hamakom hazeh, Vayiten lanu et haaretz hazot, Eretz zavat chalav udvash, at our Seders. Thank you.
Hi everyone, thank you for joining us to prepare for the Seder. I have to say we've had two Haggadah nights, one here and one at the Bayit. So I prepared one Dvar Torah for this Haggadah night, one for the one at the Bayit, and I got to hear a total of 8 Dvar Torah. So it's been a very good investment. I've got 400% returns, you know, so Yirtzeh Hashem by all of our investments. The Jewish people have just returned from Galus. They've returned from exile in Bavel, and it's Rosh Hashanah. And they go over to Ezra HaSofer, and they ask Ezra HaSofer to read from the Sefer Torah for them. And Ezra reads from the Sefer Torah, and all of the people begin to weep. And Nehemiah and Ezra go to the people, and they say, and you'll see here in source 1, Vayomer Nehemiah hu hath hirshasa, v'Ezra HaKohen HaSofer, v'Halevim HaMevinim es ha'am v'chol ha'am. So the leaders of the people, Nehemiah, Ezra, the Levim, they tell the people, Hayom Kadoshu Hashem Elokeichem. Today is a holy day for Hashem your God. Rashi explains in source 2, and then we'll jump back to the Pasuk in a minute. Hayom Kadosh Ki Yom Rosh Hashanah. It was Rosh Hashanah. And going back to the Pasuk, the leaders tell the people, Al Tisabru, don't mourn, V'al Tifku, and don't cry. Ki Vochim Ko Ha'am Kishamam Es Divrei HaTorah, because the entire people were weeping as they heard the Torah being read to them. Why were the people crying? So Rashi explains in source 2, the second line of source 2, Kivochim kol ha'am, mipnei shirokaimu ha-Torah karoi. They were weeping because as they heard the Torah being read, they realized that they hadn't been fulfilling it properly. And they were saddened. And the leaders say to them, don't cry. And the Pasuk says in Nehemiah here in source 3, Vayomer lohem, and he said to them, Lichu, ichu mashmanim, go and eat rich foods, ushesumam takim, and drink delicious drinks, vishulchu manos le'enochon lo, and send gifts to those who don't have food prepared for themselves. Ki kadosh hayom le'adoneinu, for today is holy to our Master Hashem, va'al teyatzvu, don't be saddened, ki chedvas Hashem hima uschem, for the joy of Hashem is your strength. And we can ask the question, this is Rosh Hashanah. It's the Yom HaDin, it's the Day of Judgment. And they hear the Sefer Torah being read, and they recognize that they had not been fulfilling the laws of the Torah properly, and they cry. Isn't that appropriate? Isn't that what we would expect of them? Isn't that an appropriate reaction? And the leaders tell the people, don't cry. Ki chedvas Hashem hi ma'uzchem. Because the joy of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, the joy of Hashem is your strength. There's a pasuk in Koheles, here in source 4. The pasuk says, Reichachol b'simcha lachmecha. Go and eat your bread with joy. You should say b'leiv tov yeinecha and drink your wine with a good heart. Ki chivarotza ha'elokim es ma'asecha. Because Hashem is already pleased with all of your actions. And the Medrash says on that pasuk here in source 5, Uvishah she'Yisrael niftarin mibatei kneisios mibatei midrashos. When the Jewish people leave the shuls and leave the batei medrash, bas kol yotzeis v'omeres, a heavenly voice calls out, Reichachol b'simcha lachmecha, go eat your bread with joy. Kfar nishma'at firoschem lefanai kereach nichoach, Hashem says, I have heard your prayers like a sweet-smelling offering. And I think the message that both Nehemiah and Shlomo HaMelech in Koheles are trying to teach us is the idea of being sameach b'chelko, of being happy with what we have, of rejoicing in our portion, not only in the material things that we have, but also in our level of avodas Hashem, in our level of serving HaKadosh Baruch Hu. In the Haggadah we say, uv'mora gadol zeh gilui shchina, that Hashem took us out of Mitzrayim b'mora gadol, with great awesome strength, with great awesomeness. Zeh gilui shchina, that refers to the revelation of Hashem's presence. And just as an aside, you know, I was thinking you could translate uv'mora gadol, maybe loosely translated, as totally awesome. And you know, if you would ask me what's totally awesome, I would say maybe front row seats to a Blue Jays game, a Raptors game, a Maple Leafs game. But the Baal HaHaggadah tells us what's totally awesome. Totally awesome is Gilui Shechina. Totally awesome is seeing HaKadosh Baruch Hu's presence. So when does HaKadosh Baruch Hu come and present himself? So if you would have asked me, I would have thought HaKadosh Baruch Hu comes to present himself maybe to tell us something that we're supposed to do, to give us a directive. The Ramban says on Parshas Vayera, when HaKadosh Baruch Hu comes to Avraham Avinu, here in Source 6, V'zeh gilui hashchina eilav remara v'kavod ro. Hashem revealed himself to Avraham as a way of showing Avraham honor and respect. Ke'inyan sheba b'mishkan, just like HaKadosh Baruch Hu came to the Mishkan, that Hashem appeared to the people after they completed building the Mishkan. Because of all the effort that they had put in to building the Mishkan, HaKadosh Baruch Hu revealed His presence to them. Hashem wasn't coming to them to tell them something that they had to do. HaKadosh Baruch Hu is coming to reward them for the mitzvah they already performed. U'ahodiyan, to let them know, ki ratzah elokim es ma'aseyem, to tell them that Hashem was pleased with their actions, Hashem was happy with everything that they had performed. Ka'inyan sh'ne'emar, as the pasuk says, ani b'tzedek echazef anecha, that with righteousness I'll see your face, Hashem, es ba'av ha'kitz t'munasecha, that when I wake up I'll be satisfied by seeing your image, Hashem. V'chein amru, and similarly it says, b'yardei hayam, when the Jewish people crossed the sea, she'amru zekeli v'anveyu, they pointed to Hashem, so to speak, and said, this is my God, and I'll glorify him. And Chazal tell us, Ras ha'shifcha al hayam asher ra'a Yechezkel ha'navi, that even a maid saw at the sea, a vision, a heavenly vision, that even Yechezkel the prophet didn't merit to see. Zechus rohem be'ez ha'nez ha'godol, this was their merit at the time of this great miracle, she'aminu b'Hashem u'b'Moshe avdo, for the good that they had already performed in trusting in Moshe and in HaKadosh Baruch Hu. You know, Gilui Shechina, seeing the revelation of Hashem's presence, is not something we come by every day. We're not prophets, you know, we don't merit this type of level. But we frequently feel inspiration. And inspiration is in some respects some microcosm of Gilui Shechina. And inspiration can lead us to think in two different ways. We're inspired, we recognize the value of serving HaKadosh Baruch Hu, we recognize the value of the mitzvos, and that can lead us to think in two different ways. It can be, if it's so valuable, So what about my shortcomings? I've missed things. I haven't served HaKadosh Baruch Hu perfectly. And that's what the people felt on Rosh Hashanah when they heard Ezra reading the Sefer Torah. And Ezra and Nehemiah and the leaders told the people that that's not the response that HaKadosh Baruch Hu asks of us when we're inspired. When we're inspired and we realize the value of serving HaKadosh Baruch Hu and we realize that we haven't done everything perfectly, the response that Hashem asks from us is not that we should feel bad about things that we haven't attained. The response that Hashem asks of us is Chedvas Hashem Hi Ma'uschem. If we're inspired and every mitzvah is so valuable, every good thing that we do is so valuable, so that's something that we should feel great about. Ki Chedvas Hashem Hi Ma'uschem, that the joy of Hashem is our strength. And to take this to perhaps a halachic aspect of this idea, again, there are two different approaches we can have when we recognize the value of a mitzvah. We can feel like, well, we didn't do it perfectly. We're missing out on something so great. Or we can have the reaction that HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants from us. Wow, every little bit that we do is so valuable. That's a machlokes. And there's a psak halacha on this matter. Let's look at the Shulchan Aruch here in Source 7. The Shulchan Aruch is talking about the mitzvah of Talmud Torah, of studying Torah. And the Shulchan Aruch says in Source 7, Uvishas hadchak, in a case of necessity, afilu lo kara rak kriya shma shachris va'arvis, if a person just recited shma in the morning and in the evening, lo yamushu mipicha karinan bay, it's considered as if the Torah never left his lips, that he was learning all day, that b'shas adchak, a person fulfills the mitzvah of studying Torah by just reciting kriya shma in the morning and the evening, even if he didn't learn anything beyond that. And there's a machokas in the Gemara. Is this something that we want to publicize? Learning Torah is so valuable. We want people to learn as much as they can. So there were those who argued, if we tell people that you fulfill your obligation by just reciting Shema in the morning and in the evening, people will say, okay, I'll do that and that'll be it. So maybe we shouldn't tell anyone. That's one opinion in the Gemara. But that's not how the Gemara paskins. Look at the Shach here in Source 8. The Shach, one of the classical commentaries on Shulchan Aruch, perhaps the primary commentary on Shulchan Aruch, who we follow in most cases probably, the Shach says, "V'rava amar mitzvah omro b'fnei amaretz." If there's someone who doesn't know that they can fulfill their obligation by reciting Shema in the morning and in the evening, it's a mitzvah. You should tell them that that's how they fulfill their obligation. Why is that? Then they'll say, "I fulfilled my obligation. That's it." Why would we want to share that information with them? Upiresh Rashi, and Rashi explains, Disavar, the person will think, Mishum Kriyashma, notel schar godol kazeh. If just for reciting Kriyashma, I receive such great reward, I fulfilled my mitzvah of studying Torah, about which we know the great reward of studying Torah, I receive that reward just by reciting Kriyashma in the morning and in the evening. If I would learn even more all day, certainly the reward would be even greater. He'll encourage his children and his family to study Torah. In other words, the Shach is paskening halachically that when we're faced with these two alternatives, this approach of, well, something is so valuable, so maybe I should feel bad about my shortcomings, or the approach that something is so valuable, I should feel great about every small thing that I do. The Shach Paskin's Halacha Lamaaseh said that the approach we should take is to feel great about every mitzvah that we perform. So again, we have these two approaches. They face us all the time. And the approach that Ezra and Nehemiah tell us to take is Al Tisabru V'Al Tifku. Don't mourn, don't be sad about our shortcomings. Rather, Ki chedvas Hashem hi ma'uzchem, that the joy in HaKadosh Baruch Hu is our strength. I just want to conclude by saying thank you to everyone for coming to join us, learning in preparation for the Seder. As Rabbi Torchiner mentioned at the beginning, the Seder Companion will be coming out before Shabbos. You'll be able to pick it up in Shul. You'll also be able to download it online. And thank you again. Chag Kosher v'Sameach.
Thank you, Justin.